And I guess thank you to Kevin, too, for taking most of my best lines. But it's I'm not sure if it's a good thing or a bad thing. We find ourselves in violent agreement, although we have not planned this in advance. Maybe the third speaker will undermine our best efforts to present a united front. I haven't been in Western Australia for quite a long time, but back in the 80s, I visited here on a number of occasions, and it was because of China. You know, I got to see Australia because once upon a time I learned Chinese. It was the Chinese that brought me to WA. It was the Chinese that took me particularly up to the Northwest, to drop only two really important names. I was here for the visit of, including up in the Pilbara, for the visit of then Premier Chao Tze-Yung, and again with the then Party Secretary Hu Yaobang. And I remember standing on top of Mount China with Hu Yaobang, and who was a very genuine and ebullient person, actually jumping up and down, saying, "I'm a mountain of iron, a mountain of iron." Zhengrei Zuo Tieshan. He was just very, very excited by this. Anyway, when I was approached a few months back now to buy CEDA, to be asked if I'd come and talk, I imagine I'd be making a rather different set of remarks than I'm going to make today. And overall, they probably would have been a bit more gloomy and more concentrated on the immediate impact of the financial crisis in China. And in recent years, one of the cliches of discussions about China's future, and here, both in and out of government service, and here I'm talking mainly about discussions with China experts from other countries, including the US, was that the one really serious threat China faced was not whatever you cared to name it, you know, relations with Russia turning sour, extremism, terrorism, destabilizing nuclear activity by North Korea, a more hostile Japan, cross-strait crisis. You know, you can make up your own list, all those things. No, it wasn't any of those things. The single most threat, the real threat to China came from a possible serious downturn in the US economy. But having said this, we and our interlocutors then smile at each other and move on to more immediate issues, because in this changing world, anything is possible, but nobody really seemed to think it was anywhere near probable. And the other cliche marking such discussions was that China needed to maintain a minimum of 8% annual growth in order to maintain stability, social stability, political stability. If it didn't, then all the various strains and stresses in the country would come bubbling up to the surface, and then who knew what would happen, but wherever it wasn't going to be good. Now, of course, we've had the US downturn, which has gone global, and for those of us who think about China, just about the first thing that we started to think about was how can China possibly maintain its 8% growth in these circumstances? Is this the hurdle China is not going to clear? And I use the hurdle analogy because at just about every stage of China's reform process since late 1978, we've not lacked observers, including some of the best informed and experienced observers, who said, well, you know, what they've done up until now is okay. They've really done pretty well. In fact, they've surprised us a bit. But this one is the hard one. This is the one that they're not going to bring off. And damn it, they did each time, sometimes with considerable difficulty. And there have been certainly ups and downs. There have been serious shocks to the system. Perhaps none more serious than that which we marked the 20th anniversary of last week. But it's kept on going. Now, of course, this sort of skepticism is paralleled by its opposite, which is an unalloyed marveling at an optimism about China's trajectory. But underlying the skepticism is the idea that sooner or later, it's all going to end in tears. Well, you know, so far it hasn't, and I don't think it's going to, certainly not any time soon, which is not to say that the challenges aren't huge. It does look as if China will make its 8% target this year, or get close enough to it. I should make the point, too, that its target is also has been a shibboleth for the Chinese government, as much for the Chinese government as for foreign observers. You've only got to look at the constant exhortations to Bao Ba to guarantee 8%. To be aware of this. And while 8 may be guaranteed, this could bring its own set of problems. There are issues of quality as distinct from quantity of growth which need to be addressed, and I'll come back to that if there's time. But I said that what I want to say now will differ somewhat from what I would have said a few months ago, and it's mainly because it does now appear clear that China is going to pull through the immediate crisis. And also, not this is not my area of expertise, but because of measures taken in the US and elsewhere, the crisis, although its impact is huge and ongoing, is not going to lead to a repetition of the sort of things that we saw in the 1930s with the Great Crash and the Depression. And not only is China going to pull through, though, but it seems as if it may do so in better shape than many others. So there's a question, again, if this time we can look at, about what this means in terms of the relativities of power. Now, this is a long way, though, from suggesting everything's going to be okay. And I say this because I think it's of great importance to look at what's happening not just in the context of a global financial crisis, but also in the light of where China had got to and was planning to go to in the overall development process, together with the special circumstance of what was always going to be a fraught year. I mean, at the National People's Congress in March this year, Premier Wen Jiabao said that 2009 was going to be the most difficult year economically for China, certainly in this century. The first thing to note is simply how many serious domestic problems China has to deal with, and to realize that these are the things that keep the leaders awake at night, not planning how to take over the world, not perhaps even planning how to take over Australia. Simply striving to keep the show on the road. And of course, parenthetically, that does have foreign policy implications, but I'll come back to them. Let's run through a simple list of some of the pressing problems. Corruption, protests and disturbances, serious polarization of wealth, east-west disparities, pollution, the environment. Kevin talked about the cars. That's good in one way. The other thing is to bear in mind that something like 25,000 new cars are hitting the road every day in China. 16 of the world's 20 most polluted cities, 90% of all rivers significantly polluted, 360 million people lacking access to safe drinking water. Increasing hunger for energy and resources, which we certainly know all about. Even at the spiritual, the intellectual level, all sorts of things, religions, orthodox and otherwise, at times an almost manic consumerism, variant forms of nationalism, all seeking to plug the gap left by the failure of more traditional or communist virtues. Vulnerabilities and natural disasters. Problems with minorities, HIV/AIDS and other public health issues, a stark gender imbalance, aging. Then there is the issue of political reform, which will have to be addressed seriously sooner or later. One of the things I didn't mention in that list, which I would have mentioned, say, 5 and certainly 10 years ago, is problems with the financial system. And I think we can all be extremely thankful, not only the Chinese, that in fact, over the last decade, there have been, particularly over the last 5 years, there have been some very positive measures taken to tidy up the financial system, getting rid of large numbers of non-performing loans, just in time. There's a question, of course, as to whether this massive expansion of bank lending as part of the stimulus package, which Kevin referred to, might run the danger of undermining some of the better moves in the direction of fiscal rectitude on the part of the banks, but that remains to be seen. There's certainly been very real progress there. But all of these issues, when you just think about it, makes China a very, very challenging place to govern. And I can guarantee that it's these domestic problems, as I said, that keep the leadership awake at night. And their task is made more difficult by the fact that while China is an authoritarian, one-party state, it is not totalitarian in the sense that once Beijing's issued instructions, they're carried out down the line. I mean, given the high quality of China's top leadership and the excellence of many of the advisors that the top leadership now has, we might actually wish it was a bit more totalitarian than it actually is. The problem is actually getting some of these good policies implemented down the line. So you can say China is authoritarian, if you will, but it's a very fragmented sort of authoritarianism, which leads to serious problems with governance. Again, the further you go down the line, the more that becomes an issue. So So for China's leaders, just keeping the show on the road, maintaining growth and stability while trying to get a more even spread of prosperity to fend off social upheavals is a huge challenge. It was a huge challenge before the emergence of the global financial crisis. That's just made it a whole lot more difficult than it was going to be anyway. Of course, it's easy to forget that in the first half of last year, leaving aside major issues such as the forthcoming Olympics and the tragic earthquake in Sichuan, the big challenge for the government was actually trying to control inflation and an overheating economy. So how quickly things change. But at the same time, serious structural reform was also on the agenda, including moving China towards a more domestic consumption-driven economy. Now, I don't think anybody can seriously doubt the resolution and relative effectiveness with which the Chinese authorities dealt with the immediate impact of the crisis once its scale became clear. Their arguments about the precise real value of the massive stimulation package announced by Beijing last November, and I won't go into that because Kevin's already covered it very well. It's also, of course, been supplemented by additional packages from various provincial governments, and they've certainly had a positive impact. The greatest part has, as Kevin said, gone into infrastructure development with obvious positive implications for employment, although there I'd add that people who understand these things better than I do say, although it's helpful, it's not still not nearly enough. Employment is a major issue. I mean, even before the global financial crisis, China had to find new jobs each year for approximately the population of Australia. And now you've got large numbers of laid-off migrant workers and possibly of even greater concern, serious challenge in finding employment for new university graduates. I noticed that Premier Wen Jiabao was speaking in Xi'an only yesterday, where he was talking about the problem of finding employment for 7 million new graduates coming online. Of course, he was also saying, as I'm sure is true, that the government was taking steps to try to find a good solution to that issue. But it's a major problem. On the package, there has been some criticism, and I'd say justified, of the small amount assigned to social services, especially healthcare and education. And a bigger problem with the package could be that it runs the risk of strengthening the investment-led model, which was just what China was showing signs of wishing to move away from, and delaying necessary structural adjustment. And the figures I have, which I think are reasonably accurate, are that the ratio of the industrial sector to the total economy is about 50%, which is far too high. And that makes it difficult to solve some of these sustainable development issues and the environment issues and pollution and so on, energy consumption. An overly small service sector. And one of the key questions is whether additional investment can be devoted to this sector. Education, health. I mean, one of the major reasons why the savings rate is so high is precisely because people feel, they don't just feel, they have to put money aside for the kids' education in case of problems with their health because the social safety net is not in place. Again, this is no news to the Chinese government. They know all about it. They're trying very, very hard to redress these issues, but the issues are there. For several years, China has been expanding domestic demand, but this has slowed down a bit to deal with the crisis. And there's an exchange rate issue here, too. Beijing needs to keep the RMB fairly stable for now, but in the longer term, they'll probably need to allow it to appreciate in accordance with needs for structural adjustment once the impact of the immediate impact, the external shock of the financial crisis starts to fade. Chinese government has two big advantages, though, when facing major crises such as those posed by the global financial crisis. First is strong political will and a strong capacity to mobilize resources. First is a strong political will, and the second is a strong capacity to mobilize resources. And these strengths have been clearly demonstrated by the actions of the government over the past year. And at the same time, despite a wide range of dissatisfaction and discontent in particular places over particular issues, by and large Beijing, and here I stress Beijing, rather than government and party organs at lower levels, Beijing still enjoys a good deal of prestige within the population at large, and perhaps particularly and crucially with the newly wealthy urbanites, because after all, this is the government that has presided over several decades of growing prosperity, particularly for these people, so they see it as their government. At the same time, it is a government that doesn't want to take risks, and we've seen throughout this year of sensitive political anniversaries, and none more so than last week's, it'll take extraordinary measures to ward off anything that it sees as at all threatening in the political sphere. Though it is important, I think, and again trying to be fair, to distinguish between the restriction of political freedoms and the increasingly wide latitude given socially, which is at least, if not more important to many people, certainly in terms of their daily lives. The amount of freedom, by which I mean freedom to make crucial decisions about how you live your own life, that the Chinese people enjoy now, is absolutely, would have been unrecognizable to people living in China 15 or 20 years ago. And we sometimes forget that. This generally cautious approach by the government, and you can understand, facing the sort of issues that they are facing, why they would want to be cautious, it militates against introducing further social institutional reforms, including those that were already on the agenda. And the immediate tends to trump the longer term. Now, Chinese government, again, is hardly unique in this regard, but it's China we're talking about today. And some provincial governments, for instance, have already shown this by removing minimum wage standards to increase competitiveness, shelving transition to more capital and technology-intensive production by returning to labor-intensive industries such as garment manufacturing. And similarly, delaying further institutional reform and experiments with democracy, cracking down on lawyers involved in defense of sensitive or controversial cases, imposing tighter media restrictions and so on, all of which we've seen through recent months in particular, further reduce the limited options and mechanisms available for citizens to express concerns peacefully and legally. But I will acknowledge here the possibility that some of these restrictions may be relaxed to a degree and debates about democratization and political reform revived if Beijing gets through this year without too many major alarms and excursions. And again, we have to remind ourselves that actually, intellectually, China these days is an enormously vibrant place. There are any number of debates going on across the country, and the latitude which people, particularly people, can be, I guess, generally relied upon not to let things get out of hand. Basically, putting it somewhat crudely, perhaps people like us, you can say a great deal, you can discuss a great deal. I think that sooner or later, pretty soon probably, Beijing is going to have to make a conscious decision to move away from some of the shorter-term emergency fixed measures that's been taken quite effectively up to now, and begin to address the longer-term, more difficult questions of structural adjustment and reform, including further political reform, because if it doesn't, it will just be storing up trouble further down the track. Now, so far I've concentrated on the domestic, and my time's going to expire shortly, but the old diplomat in me wouldn't allow me to sit down without at least some reference to the impact of what we've been discussing on China's international presence. The first point to make is that the reason why the global financial crisis has impacted on China to the degree that it has is precisely because China has become such an important international player, economically and reflecting that increasingly politically and strategically. And the second is that if China emerges at the end of this crisis in reasonable shape, as I've been arguing is likely, is a likely if not certain outcome, then its prestige will have been further augmented. China was becoming more confident internationally before the crisis anyway, but the momentum has been accelerated and is likely to continue. So China's economic power has increased to a level where Beijing is well placed to demand a greater position in international institutions and within regional multilateral mechanisms. And although Beijing is still outside the G8 and plays only a minor role in the IMF and the World Bank, the crisis is increasing the importance of China's role in the international economy and reinforcing the need for its inclusion. I don't work for the government anymore, but I think, and I can say this perhaps because I don't work for the government, I actually agree with them. I think the Prime Minister is absolutely right on this point, that China has to be given a greater role in these major international institutions. And that's right. Not just good for China, but it's in Australia's interests. Given the importance of our bilateral relationship, China has to be given a greater role in such institutions. And this is what encouraging China to be, in Robert Zoellick's words, a responsible stakeholder is all about. Now, while there is possibly a danger that some in China might see the global financial crisis as having further undermined U.S. global standing, and given encouragement to those who might wish to begin to challenge its position, particularly in the region, and such people do exist. China is a big country. There are many views. I think on balance, this is unlikely to happen, at least not for a while. Of course, a lot depends on the speed and completeness of America's recovery, but if anything, the crisis has only further emphasized to both sides the importance to which the importance of the one for the other, and the degree to which they are interlocked. I mean, you just look at the recent spate of visits to Beijing, Clinton, Pelosi, Geithner, for an illustration of that. And moreover, with the relaxation of cross-strait relations, which is the principal irritant in Sino relations, following on from the election of the Kuomintang and Ma Ying-jeou last year, on the one hand, and challenges to regional stability posed not least by North Korea on the other, now is not the time for China to want to pick unnecessary fights with the United States. And then again, there's a whole range of new global issues, climate change, global warming being only one, which have to be addressed by China and the United States together. And at these recent top-level visits, these are very much the issues that are being concentrated on. So I'm pretty optimistic there, which is so important for Australia, because there is nothing that more determines our strategic well-being or otherwise than the status of the relationship between China and the United States. That's what really determines our strategic environment. So if things are going well there, it's good for us. If not, it's bad for us. It's as simple as that. Just on Taiwan, this is my closing point. While the global financial crisis has made it difficult, if not impossible, for President Ma Ying-jeou to restore his popularity through a speedy economic revival, which was what everybody was hoping for, by seriously undermining Taiwan's economic position, the crisis actually strengthened Taiwan's economic dependence on Beijing. And has also, it's just very, very difficult now for anyone in Taiwan to try to claim that the economic ties with the mainland aren't actually all that important. They are fundamental and just getting more and more important. And that obviously has to have implications in other areas. It's also potentially lowered Taipei's capacity to maintain the high levels of defense spending, which was thought it required to compete with Beijing. I mean, the cross-strait military balance was, and the nature of the relationship were probably already trending in that direction, but the global financial crisis certainly accelerated that shift. Now, as long as President Ma continues his current cross-strait policies and Beijing reciprocates accordingly, stepping back from the urge to speed up reunification while guarding against de jure independence, and concentrates on strengthening positive and beneficial cross-strait contacts, and all of that is what's happening, prospects for calmer Beijing-Taipei relations are reasonable, and this, again, is very much for the good as far as Australia is concerned. I'll leave it there. Thank you very much, everyone.